Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 215, right as we swing into 1960, the last year of the Eisenhower administration, and as Kennedy was barreling toward a November election win against Nixon. As you know, I like to go on small wanders, and rather than just giving you the rest of the timeline between 1960 and 1963, I'm going to pause and tell you one of the most amazing stories of the civil rights movement. Of course, there are so many, but this is one of my favorite. And it's a short little wander about the Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins. This was a time when the move toward desegregation of schools was quickly evolving into a more full-blown civil rights movement that had been steadily gathering steam from 1954 on, after the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And white opposition to this movement was growing in proportion, and with some fringe elements already beginning to introduce or step up the violence against the movement. 1960 saw the growth of a phenomenon that had been previously introduced into the civil rights movement. It was the lunch counter sit-in, another brilliant and nonviolent protest that would soon go viral as a result of the actions of a group of students in Greensboro, North Carolina. Sit-ins were not exactly new. You can reach back to notable events through civil rights history. In 1939 in Virginia, and in 1942 in Chicago, 49 in St. Louis, and 52 in Baltimore. All were notable, but the most famous one began on February 1, 1960, when four young African-American students from North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College sat down at the Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro. The old Woolworth store was located at 132 Elm Street in Greensboro. And back then, it was quite common for a small retail store like that to have a lunch counter. And this particular Woolworth store had a large one. It seated 66 people. The four men were Ezell Blair, Jr., David Richman, Franklin McCain, and Joseph McNeil. And these four men would later become known as the A&T Four, or the Greensboro Four. Their tactic was simple. They would walk into the store and initially purchase small products from a desegregated counter at the store, because somehow buying products in the same place was somehow different than eating together in the same place, a practice that the white community still considered off-limits. So the Greensboro Four encountered no problems with this initial step, and therefore established themselves at the same time as patrons of Woolworth's. But that was just step one. Next, they would make their way over to the lunch counter, and they would order up a cup of coffee with some cream on the side and a donut. And at this point, they were promptly refused service, as they knew they would be. According to a witness, a white waitress told the boys, and I quote, "We don't serve Negroes here." Blair, one of the four, responded that he was just served 2 feet away at the desegregated retail counter, to which the waitress replied again, "Negroes eat at the other end." An African-American girl who was cleaning behind the counter called them stupid, ignorant, rabble-rousers, troublemakers. Not surprising, as so many in both the black community and the white community knew that whether you agreed or not, it was bound to bring trouble of some sort. Another African-American told them, "You're just hurting race relations by sitting there." But not everybody felt that way, and not every white person felt that way. An elderly white woman there at the store that day allegedly said to them, "I'm just so proud of you. My only regret is that you didn't do this 10 or 15 years ago." The store manager was a man named Clarence Harris. He would get involved next, and he asked the four young men to leave, but they wouldn't budge. Harris would then call his supervisor, who told him, they'll soon give up, they'll soon leave, and they'll soon be forgotten. But this prediction proved to be as far away from the truth as you might be able to get, as far away from what actually occurred over the next several days. Poetically, Harris, on the orders of his supervisor, allowed the students to stay, and he did not call the police to evict them. The four freshmen stayed until the store closed that night, and then they went back to the North Carolina A&T College campus, where they recruited more students to join them the next morning. The next day, on February 2, 1960, more than 20 black students, including four women, recruited from other campus groups, joined the sit-in. This group sat with schoolwork to stay busy from about 11 a.m. in the morning to about 3 p.m. that afternoon. The group was, again, refused service, and this time they were harassed by the white customers at the Woolworth store that had begun to gather. This sit-in was starting to gather attention, and it did make the local news on the second day, with reporters, a TV cameraman, and police officers present throughout the day. Back on campus that night, the Student Executive Committee for Justice was organized, and the committee sent a letter asking the president of F.W. Woolworth to, and I quote, take a firm stand to eliminate discrimination. Upon hearing of the sit-ins, the president of the college, Warmoth T. Gibbs, would glibly reply that Woolworth's, and I quote, did not have the reputation for fine food. The students would write the following letter to the president of Woolworth's. Dear Mr. President, we, the undersigned, are students at the Negro College in the city of Greensboro. Time and time again, we have gone into Woolworth's stores in Greensboro. We have bought thousands of items at the hundreds of counters in your stores. Our money was accepted without rancor or discrimination, and with politeness towards us. When, at a long counter just 3 feet away, our money is not acceptable because of the color of our skins. We are asking your company to take a firm stand to eliminate discrimination. We firmly believe that God will give you courage and guidance in solving the problem. Sincerely yours, the Student Executive Committee. On the third day, February 3, 1960, the number grew to over 60, including students from Dudley High School. An estimated one-third of the protesters were women, many of them students from Bennett College, which was an historically black women's college in Greensboro. The opposition was growing, too, as everyone knew it would be in that moment. White customers heckled the black students as those students stood their ground at the lunch counters, quietly sitting, reading, and studying, waiting to be served, and knowing they wouldn't be, at least not yet, on this day. And as expected, the lunch counter staff continued to refuse service. North Carolina's official chaplain of the Ku Klux Klan, George Dorsett, as well as other members of the Klan, would show up and make themselves known. What a frightening moment that must have been. And from the national headquarters, the corporate tower of F.W. Woolworth would simply come this message. They would say that the company would, and I quote, abide by local custom and maintain its segregation policy. Despite the anticipated resistance, this nonviolent protest began to take off exponentially. On February 4, 1960, more than 300 people took part. The group now included students not only from North Carolina A&T, from Bennett College, and from Dudley High School, but from other institutions around the area. And they would fill the entire seating area at the lunch counter. Three white female students from the Women's College at the University of North Carolina, now the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, Jeannie Seaman, Marilyn Lott, and Ann Dearsley all joined the protests and sat at the counter. Organizers agreed to expand the sit-in protests to include the lunch counter at Greensboro's S.H. Kress & Company store, and they did so that day, another store there in town. And in perhaps the first sign of progress, students, college administrators, and representatives from F.W. Woolworth and Kress met to discuss the entire circumstance. But the stores would stand resolute and refused to integrate. So the meeting would end without progress on the core issue. But it was a step. By February 5th, tensions at the Woolworth store were beginning to grow exponentially as well. The counter would now see a sit-in of a different type, when 50 white men emerged on the scene and sat at the counter in opposition to the protesters, which now included white college students as well. One thing was for sure, this little Woolworth store in little old Greensboro, North Carolina, was getting a lot of attention. Again, on this day, more than 300 people were at the store by 3 o'clock that afternoon, at which time the police removed two young white customers for swearing and yelling, and then police arrested three white patrons before the store closed at 5:30 p.m. It was getting ugly. Another meeting between students, college officials, and store representatives took place, and again, there was no resolution. The store representatives were frustrated that only certain segregated stores were being protested against, and they asked for intervention by the college's administrators, while some administrators suggested a temporary closure of the counters. The weekend was now upon the event, and on Saturday, February 6th, over 1,400 North Carolina A&T students met in the Richard B. Harrison Auditorium on campus. They voted to continue the protests, and they went, all of them, to the Woolworth store, filling up the store. More than 1,000 protesters and counter-protesters packed themselves into the store by noon. And then what came next is, I guess, when you are dealing with supremacy groups, a play right out of their standard playbook. Around 1 p.m., a bomb threat, set for 1:30 p.m., was delivered by call to the store. And it caused the protesters to head to the Kress store, which, of course, in light of the bomb threat, already known, immediately closed, along with the Woolworth store as well. The sit-in movement would spread to other southern cities, including Winston-Salem, Durham, Raleigh, Charlotte, Richmond, Virginia, and Lexington, Kentucky. In Nashville, Tennessee, students of the Nashville Student Movement were trained by civil rights activist James Lawson and had already started the sit-in process when Greensboro occurred. The Nashville sit-ins attained desegregation of the downtown department store lunch counters in May 1960. Miraculously, most of these protests were peaceful, but there were instances of violence. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, tensions rose between blacks and whites, and fights broke out. In Jackson, Mississippi, students from Tupelo College staged a sit-in on May 28, 1963. A chilling account of that event is included in the autobiography of Ann Moody, who was a participant that day, in her book, Coming of Age in Mississippi. And she describes their treatment from whites who were at the counter when they sat down, the formation of the mob in the store, and how they managed finally to leave. Most of this was peaceful, but none of it could be engaged in if you were faint-hearted. The sit-ins spread to other forms of public accommodation, including transport facilities, swimming pools, libraries, art galleries, parks and beaches, and museums. And most of these sit-ins occurred primarily in the South. Back in Greensboro, as the sit-ins continued, tensions started growing. Students began a far-reaching boycott of stores with segregated lunch counters. And in the end, the good old dollar prevailed. Sales at the boycotted stores dropped by a third, leading their owners to abandon their segregation policies. On Monday, July 25th, 1960, after incurring nearly $200,000 in losses, perhaps more than $2 million in current dollars. And after a reduction in salary for not meeting his sales goals, store manager Clarence Harris would ask four black employees, Geneva Tisdale, Susie Morrison, Anetha Jones, and Charles Best, to change out of their work clothes and order a meal at the counter. They were, quietly, the first blacks ever to be served at a Woolworth lunch counter.
Greensboro Four were yours truly, Joe McNeil, David Richmond, Junior Blair, and Frank McCain. We all lived in the same dormitory. I think we were all very young. I was the youngest, I was 17. I reacted to the Jim Crow South with anger. I did not believe for one minute that I was a second-class citizen, that I was inferior in any way to whites, greens, whatever. I couldn't live the lie. We decided to take a stand. Let's go. Let's do it. So we purchased small items, sundry items, to establish the fact that we were customers. And then we sat down on a stool and asked for a cup of coffee. And the store manager told us that he wasn't going to serve us. The local establishment grossly underestimated our anger and the ability to hang in there. So when we were leaving the store, the Associated Press was there. And they said, "Hey, boys, what you going to do?" We said, "Well, we're going to come back. And we're going to keep coming back until you decide to serve us." We started growing. First day, four. The second day, probably 16 or 20. It was organic. It was a mind of its own. It kept growing. We decided that whatever actions we were going to take, they were going to be nonviolent. We remained nonviolent. But on the third day, it started to get rough. At any time, we could have been carried out of that store in a pine box. We didn't want to be martyrs, but we had to do what we needed to do.
I was a student at Fisk University in Nashville. February 1st, 1960, we heard that four young black men sat in at a lunch counter in Greensboro. We had our first sit-in in Nashville on February 13th. I'm really amused sometimes because people say, "Oh, you were so brave." And the truth is, I was afraid the whole time. But the choice was to do what was necessary to end segregation or to tolerate segregation. And that just was not acceptable.
Greensboro became the message. It was like, if they can do it in Greensboro, we too can do it. And there were young people and people not so young, adults, in major cities outside of the South, participating, sitting in at lunch counters. They were picketing the stores to support the students in the South. And you had people like Martin Luther King Jr. saying things like, "By sitting down, we were standing up for the very best in American tradition."
And I think that's really important for people to know that it was ordinary people, quote unquote ordinary, like themselves, who did everything for the civil rights movement. that it was really a people's movement.
These young people injected something very meaningful, something really beautiful. So you may not have a lot of money. You may not have a lot of power. But you have what Dr. King and Gandhi and others call soul power. Just using your body as a nonviolent instrument, as a tool, you can change things. You can inspire hundreds and thousands and millions of people to speak up, to speak out.
I walked away with an attitude that if our country is screwed up, don't give up. Unscrew it. Don't give up. Which in retrospect is pretty good for a bunch of teenagers.
One of the most defining aspects of the movements, and particularly civil rights movement, was the fact that we had to have faith. And you hear the religious leaders talk about that, how important faith was. And faith to me was very simple, that if some sucker comes up and smashes me in the back of the head with his fist or a brick while I'm carrying my picket sign, my faith would tell me that there's going to be somebody there on my side to pick up that picket sign and carry on, that if I have to give my life, it won't be in vain. So appreciate the aspect of faith and what it can do for you. It's important to have, the old folks would say, faith in something, son. We can be as good as we're able.
Just thinking about general advice to give to the youth today, what's some advice you give them in staying involved in social movements?
If I were to try to summarize some thoughts in terms of encouragement, don't forget that intolerance still exists and is growing. Where you really need to be engaged and involved. We ought to need to be involved in something to make the world a better place, all of us, over time. Remember the lessons of the past. Remember how we effectively use nonviolence and the fact that we still need to figure out how to use that in situations in the future. Remember that we didn't get to where we are unless somebody went ahead of us and made some sacrifices. We've got to remember all those people involved in our past who made it possible for you and I to have an education and to have jobs and families. I think of the people I'm thankful for, the Tuskegee Airmen and people like that who sacrificed so that I might succeed one day. I think about the people from Freedom Summer and the Medgar Evers and the bus rides and the sit-ins. And remember that I, too, have an obligation to carry forward the effort, in addition to preparing myself for careers and raising a family. So it's a lot to ask.
Well,
but I feel comfortable thinking your generation is up to the task.
I hope so. And I think we've got a lot of great leaders coming up. So I hope we'll make some great changes to our country.
Thank you for listening to episode 215 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.